Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dialect Coach's Corner podcast, the place where we love exploring language and the way people speak it. I'm Jerome Butler, your dialect coach, and we're out here today a stone's throw from Gotham City, the Big Apple, in the borough of Churches, BK, Kings County, Greenpoint, Brooklyn, in New York. And you're in for a treat today, folks, because I have as my guest a very talented and deeply committed servant to the city of New York. He worked for almost 24 years with the NYPD, spending over 20 of those years on the job as a detective with New York's Finest. After his time on the force, he's gone on to make his mark as the go-to police technical advisor for shows shot here in New York, including The Unusuals, Law and Order, Life on Mars, Salt, Golden Boy, Ironside, Unforgettable, and he's currently working as a technical advisor and now a producer on the popular CBS show Blue Bloods. I've had the pleasure of working with him on more than one occasion, and if we had a studio audience, they'd be putting their hands together right now for Jim Nusifora. Welcome to the podcast, Jim.
Thank you, Jerome.
Congratulations on your continued success with Blue Bloods. You guys are entering your fifth season?
Yes, that's correct.
We're here in the studios in Greenpoint today.
This is the kitchen for the Reagan household.
This is Tom Selleck's kitchen.
That's right, his kitchen, and right behind us is the living room where the famous family dinners take place, the dining room.
And now tell me, Jim, how much of the show is shot here in the studio, and how much do you guys actually go outside of the studio to shoot?
Okay, each episode takes approximately 8 days to shoot.
Right.
Out of those 8 days, we'll do, for the most part, we'll do four of them on the, you know, in the studio, and four of them on location. Each episode varies. Sometimes it's, you know, 5 and 3, but for the most part, it's half and half.
What kind of places do you go on the street when you shoot?
Wherever we need to go, if we need a bank scene, a bodega, anything. But the thing with this show is they love to showcase New York City.
Yeah.
So if you watch the show, you'll see quite often there's amazing sights of the city. You know, you'll have shots going up avenues in Manhattan where you'll see the Empire State Building in the background. Or we'll do lots of shots by the water where you'll see the bridges. So we kind of showcase New York City.
Greatest character in the world. New York City.
That's right.
Let's just start by having you tell me a little bit about your time on the force. You know, a little bit about your background with the NYPD.
Okay. I became a cop in New York City in 1982, in January of 1982, actually. And initially, I was a member of the New York City Transit Police. Mm-hmm. At the time, in 1982, there were three separate police departments within the city. There was the NYPD, who was considered Big Brother at that time.
Right, right.
Then there was the New York City Transit Police. And then there was a slightly smaller department, the New York City Housing Police.
Right.
For years, they had talked about combining the three departments and making one large department via a merge. But it never really came to fruition. And then after Rudy Giuliani became mayor, sometime in, I believe, 1994, he merged the three departments into one large NYPD with a New York City Transit Bureau and a housing bureau.
Hmm.
So it is now just one big department.
Yes, and that's where you started.
That's where I started. So from there, I was on patrol only for maybe a year and a half, 2 years. I worked out in Coney Island. And then in 1984, I went into a plainclothes task force. And it was a citywide unit. We worked all over the city in plainclothes, just targeting different crimes and different conditions. From there, I was asked to go into a decoy unit.
Yeah.
And this was a decoy unit on the New York City subway system back in the mid to late 80s. And I don't know if you remember what the subway system was like then.
Wild Wild West,
baby.
That's
right. That's exactly what it was. It's an experience I would never trade in for anything in the world. I met some great people. I worked with some great people. And I even arrested some amazing people, some very interesting people. From there, I became a detective, and I worked in different units. I worked in a robbery squad. I worked in Transit District Detective Squad, which is the equivalent of an NYPD precinct detective squad.
Right.
So we handled all types of cases there. Mm. We handled everything from homicides to grand larcenies, robberies, anything you can think of. I worked in a major case squad. And at some point, the merge did take place. The three departments were merged. And I went to work for Commissioner Bratton.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in his office for a little while, and then there was a deputy commissioner, a man by the name of Jack Maple, who was an amazing person. He was a brilliant police strategist. And he was the person who developed the CompStat program that they still use today in the NYPD. And they actually use it all over the world as a method to fight crime.
What does CompStat mean?
Okay, it stands for computer statistics. It's computer-generated crime statistics. What they do is they look at the statistics of the crimes, where they're happening, when they're happening. Mm. You deploy your manpower based on those statistics. But more important is that they use those statistics to hold the bosses within the NYPD accountable. Mm. Meaning they would have these CompStat meetings and they would bring in, let's say, all the bosses and all the squad commanders from Brooklyn North. And they would say, okay, you know, let's look at the chart we have on the wall here. Mm-hmm. And I see that, you know, you have all these robberies occurring in your precinct. The majority of them are on Friday nights after midnight, which is the first platoon. And I look at your manpower charts, and that's when your manpower is the lowest. So why are you giving off all of your cops on a Friday night? We all know everybody wants to be home on a Friday night with their families, but with the police. Put the cops out there. It created an accountability.
Yeah.
It brought down crime.
So really, you had an opportunity to be in just a lot of different environments within the department.
Yes. My career was very diversified. I got to see a lot. I worked up in the commissioner's office.
Yeah.
I worked with homicide squads. I worked in a drug enforcement task force, which was a task force comprised of NYPD detectives, DEA agents, and New York State Police. And we worked out of DEA headquarters. They gave you your own car. It was a nice place to be. And you worked on some big cases and some interesting cases.
So you've worked as a technical advisor on a lot of television shows and films. Can you talk a little bit about how the police technical advisor position came into being?
Okay, I can tell you how it came into being for me. I can only assume that it came into being because producers, writers wanted their shows to be technically correct, and I'm sure actors the same. They know that the people, the cops, are going to be watching these shows, and they want them to be technically correct. For me, it came into being through the man I had mentioned earlier, Jack Maple, who was a deputy commissioner in the NYPD, very colorful, very charismatic. He was an amazing person, so much so that CBS fashioned the show after Jack, and it was called The District.
Wow.
And Craig T. Nelson portrayed Jack Maple, in the television show The District.
Wow.
Well, what happened was, after their third season, I believe it was, Jack passed away. Jack was young. He was only 48 years old. And they needed somebody to keep Jack alive for their writers. So I started working with them, not as a technical advisor or a technical consultant, but more of a storyteller. They knew I knew Jack well. And I assured them that I was no Jack Maple, but I did know his stories. I knew what he did, and I knew how he did it. So I flew out to the writer's room, which they wrote out in L.A., and I would fly out there and sit down with the writers, and I would just tell them Jack's stories. So the show went on for two more seasons based on stories that we told about Jack. After, I believe it was their fifth season, the show ended, and some of the writers started going to other shows and getting their own shows. And they started calling, saying, hey, it's a New York City show. You know, do you want to do the technical advising on it? And I was sure, you know, I'd love to do it. And that's how it all began for me.
That's amazing. I did not know that. I really didn't know. As much as we've talked about this, I didn't know that that's how you started out.
Nothing I ever planned just kind of happened.
Yeah.
Like when you meet the right, like that's how I met my wife. You know, nothing I ever planned just kind of happened.
So how do you serve as a resource to writers and producers and actors? How does that work?
Well, much like the story I told about how I became a technical advisor, I'm still a storyteller. So I work for Blue Bloods now. Mm. So what we'll do is the writers will develop their stories. And while they're developing the story, they'll call me and they'll say, Jim, you know, I'd like to do this. Does this sound feasible? You know, can we do this? And then I'll speak to them about that. And they'll say, you know, I'm having trouble getting from point A to point B. How would we do that?
Mm.
And I walk them through that, and I help them with that. And once their script is complete, I get the script, and I read the script. And then I'll supply them with notes on the script. And I'll say, okay, you know, this does work. We spoke about that, but we didn't speak fully on it. So maybe you want to try this. Maybe you want to try that. And then I'll plug in the NYPD jargon or I'll read something and I'll say, you know, that works, but there's something that exists in the NYPD, which is X, and, you know, that may work better here. So I give them different ideas. With Blue Bloods, while they're shooting the episode, the writers stay on the set. Yeah. So we're at Video Village every day. And for those of you who don't know what Video Village is, while we're shooting an episode, there are monitors set up on the set somewhere where the people who work on the show can watch what's going on, because they can't all be in that same room while the scene is being filmed. So it enables the people who work on the show to watch the show as it's going on. For me, that's important because I can see the action. I can see what the actors are doing. For wardrobe, it's important because they can see the wardrobe. Mm. For hair and makeup, they can see the actors and make sure their hair is fine and their makeup is fine. So while I'm sitting there for 8 days each episode with the writers, they talk to me, they'll ask me questions, they'll pick my brains. But more often than not, I'm just telling them stories. And they're old war stories, and my family's heard them a million times, but the actors haven't.
Yes.
And the actors just pick them apart and take things that they like. And quite often, they'll fashion their scripts either after a story, or they'll use one of my stories for a piece of their script.
Yes.
And that's how I work with them.
How do you find that the language aspect of it comes into play?
The language aspect of it for the writers is a little difficult, only because the NYPD kind of has its own language. And it's nothing that there's any rhyme or reason to. You know, it's nothing that you can envision, imagine. It's just something. It's on-the-job training. It's something you learn while you're working. So, and that's very important. That keeps it real.
What is some of the particular language that you would hear on the job in the department that would sound strange to the rest of us?
Let's take something where one cop to another, not so much today, more so years ago, when you'd go into a restaurant. The restaurant didn't want to accept money from the cop for their meal. Now, doesn't happen quite as often nowadays. One, because the restaurant's not looking to foot that bill, and number two, you're not allowed to take that meal. You weren't allowed to take it then either, but nobody bothered you. But cops talking back then would say, you know, where can I go eat? You know, or where's somewhere good to eat? Now, when cops are talking to cops and you're looking for somewhere good to eat, has nothing to do with the quality of the food. Okay?
Right.
You know, it just has more to do with the amount of food they give you,
yes,
and how much it costs. So you may say, you know, go over to Joe's Diner. It's on the arm there. Now, on the arm, what does that mean? I don't know the origin of it, but it means it's for free. It means you're not going to be paying for it. Or there's the term master shield, meaning, you know, as a cop, you'll go somewhere and they're not going to accept any money, but they don't know who you are, so maybe you got to show them your shield. They call that master shield. You show your shield.
Nice.
It correlates to MasterCard, you know, like the credit card.
Nice.
Other things such as, you know, to tune somebody up. That means you have to get physical with them. So, you know, I tuned that guy up. You got into it with him, and it got physical. There are many terms. The house. The house means actually the precinct. You say, I'm going 63 at the house. Well, 63 refers to a 1063, which means you're taking your meal. And the house means the precinct. So I'm going 1063 at the house means I'm going to eat my lunch at the house. Any meal you take during the day, be it what a normal person would classify as breakfast, lunch, or dinner, to you is now just your meal. Other things, a bus, that's an ambulance. You know, you'd get on the radio and say, listen, I need a bus at this location. They know you need an ambulance. In the bag is a term used meaning you're going to be working in uniform. So at some point when you're not a rookie anymore, some days you'll go in and maybe you'll be working anti-crime or plain clothes. And then the boss may say, well, listen, you know, you've been working plain clothes for the last week. For the next week, you're going to be in the bag. That means you're going to be putting your uniform on and going back on patrol.
Is there a generational aspect to jargon? Is there jargon and is there language that would make sense or resonate to someone who was retired now and wouldn't resonate to a young 30-year-old cop?
Sure. Things have changed. And the for me, what I consider to be the good part, I came in, as I said earlier, in 1982, I came on the job. And for me, that was a great time, only because technology was not nearly what it was today. So I was coming in at the end of an era. I started in 1982, so there were still cops on the job, who started in 1962. And for the most part, an NYPD officer, their full retirement, they can take after 20 years on the job. So in 1982, we still have plenty of cops who came on in 1962 or thereafter. 1965, 66 were the very big years for hiring. And then I stayed through 2005. So I got to see the new generation and I got to see how things evolved within the department. You know, when I first came on the job, as a cop, you carry a nightstick. Well, in the academy, they would give you a nightstick and it was made out of pine. And almost everybody I knew one way or the other would break their nightstick. Not on a person, I'm not talking about, and I've heard guys tell me, you know, I hit someone in the shins with the stick and it broke. But my stick broke and I don't recall how I broke mine. Certainly wasn't hitting somebody with it. Right. I wasn't of that ilk. I wasn't a very heavy-handed cop. If somebody wanted to throw down, I had no problem with that. But once the cuffs were on, game was over. So let's take a term like wood shampoo. When I first came on the job, a wood shampoo meant that you had your nightstick, which was made out of wood, and that when you used it on somebody's head, you gave them a wood shampoo.
Wow.
Nowadays, these cops come on the job, they have no clue what a wooden nightstick is.
Right.
It's made out of plastic or some kind of polymer. So wood shampoo doesn't go anymore. And the saddest part of all, Jerome, is next to my bed, I still keep my last nightstick that I had on the job. It was actually my second nightstick that I ever had.
Yeah.
My first one I broke.
Yeah.
And then this nightstick, years and years and years ago, I took off a skeller, as we would call them, on the train, who had this nightstick, and he was banging on seats, and I have no idea where he got the nightstick. I can only assume some cop must have sat down on the train and left it on the train, and he found it. I took that nightstick, and that's the nightstick I've kept for the rest of my career, and I still have. But the point I'm getting at is there was nothing like being out there, especially on a midnight, twirling that baton.
Yeah.
That is an art. There are so many different ways to twirl it. And I have a 12-year-old daughter and an 8-year-old son, and the both of them can twirl that baton, a nightstick, it's called a baton, like they're champs. And I can still do it, and I love doing it, and cops nowadays have no clue as to how to twirl a baton. There's no more leather thong on it.
Yeah.
You know, now it's the asp, it's the expandable nightstick, yes, which is in essence a pipe. You know, it's a metal pipe.
A policing technology that's now disappeared.
That's right, but it has evolved. And I'd have to say, yes, for the better. And another point I was making about the nightstick is when I first came on the job in the Transit Police Department, many police officers carried axe handles instead of their nightstick. They would go to a hardware store and buy like an oak or whatever the heavy wood was, axe handle, cut it down a little bit, but it was much longer than the average nightstick, and they would drill a hole through it and put a leather thong in it, and that was their nightstick.
That was their nightstick.
Yes, and you didn't even really have to use it. Just carrying it was intimidating. Nobody messed with you.
Did you call that implement something different than a regulation nightstick?
I've heard it called the persuader. I don't know how widespread that was, but in the district where I worked, it was called the persuader.
Right. Now, what is a district? Because we think of precincts. What's the difference between a...
Okay. Districts still exist. Remember I told you about the old transit districts when the Transit Police Department was a separate entity? So a transit district was the equivalent of an NYPD precinct. After the merge, the districts remained. Mm-hmm. So there still are NYPD precincts. In the Transit Bureau, you'll have districts. They are police precincts within the subway.
Mm-hmm.
And then the PSAs, a PSA stands for a police service area, and that is the equivalent of a precinct for the housing police. And there are numerous PSAs located throughout the city, either in the confines of or on the outskirts of housing projects.
You know, you were talking about transit police, and that's where the term district originally came from. Talk to me about what a turnstile sucker is, or was.
Okay. Tokens no longer exist. But when I was with the transit police, a token was how you entered the subway. And it was for, I don't know, 100 years.
Yeah.
So in my day, we had to deal with token suckers. And they were criminals albeit low-level crimes, but they were criminals, and what they would do is stuff up a turnstile. They would either stick paper in the aperture where you put your token, or they would get like a wood ice cream stick and stick it in there and break it off, but then push it down a little more. So they would stuff it up just so that if you put a token in, it would go in just enough. It wouldn't drop down into the turnstile to make the turnstile work, and it wouldn't stick out enough so that you can get it out. So you would, in essence, lose your token. And there it would sit. Well, the token sucker would just wait for you to leave, and then he would come over, put his mouth on top of the aperture, and suck out the token. And now he has that token. And he can either use that token, but more often than not, he would sell it. Or he would stand by the token booth and sell it to people for a discount coming up to buy tokens.
Wow. Fascinating look at previous technology. We'll be right back with Jim Nusaforo.